compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Welcome. Excuse me. Welcome back. This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio, as you probably already know, because you're either listening on Relevant Radio or you are listening on one of our nearly 190 stations around the country. That is so awesome. I want to share with you a couple quick things before we go to the phones. First of all, the Wall Street Journal has an article entitled "The Best Coupon in Your Wallet." What do you think it is? Cyrus, what do you think the best coupon is that you can get right now?
Kohl's Cash. I don't know.
You sound like my wife. She shops at Kohl's.
Yeah, so does mine.
Yeah.
I don't know. What do you got?
Okay, what's in your wallet? Where have I heard that before? The Wall Street Journal says it's your vaccination card. So check it out. For many Americans, getting the coronavirus vaccine is a reward unto itself. But for Patricia Fasnacht, the shot came with a sugary bonus. That could be a good garage band name, sugary bonus. Ever since receiving her first injection of the Pfizer vaccine, are we keeping track of these good garage band names to add to our list, Cyrus?
No, that has definitely fallen by the wayside.
All right, start adding sugary bonus. That goes on the list. Mrs. Fasnacht, a 62-year-old resident of High Point, North Carolina, has taken advantage of the Krispy Kreme promotion, which it was recently announced is offering a free daily donut through the end of 2021. Remember, we talked about that. And then there was a mysterious absence after the show was over and you were gone for about 20 minutes and you came back with a donut. I remember that. You came back with three
donuts. Was it that obvious?
And I don't know how many you ate before you got back. But yeah, so they're giving away, you remember this, Cyrus, the free donut at Krispy Kreme every day until the end of the year, as long as you can furnish evidence that
you know, I wasn't going to get vaccinated, but now thanks to Krispy Kreme, now I'm going to do it for the Krispy Kreme.
If we were to say it tipped the scale, that would be true in two ways.
That's right.
I wonder if she will be in line for the eventual diabetes vaccine. And then like Whole Foods will give you a free stick of broccoli if you go in there every day for a year. Krispy Kreme has 369 locations around the U.S., and they estimate that it has doled out 125,000 donuts in the first 96 hours. I wonder how many of those are Patrick Madrid Show listeners, because we talked about that. The push to get shots in your arm has morphed into a kind of freebie frenzy. Cyrus, that's another excellent garage band name. Freebie Frenzy. Would you go see them at Coachella?
Only if everyone's vaccinated.
I think that's a great name, Freebie Frenzy. So here's the thing. A whole bunch of different companies are using the incentive to get, using the idea of getting your vaccination as an incentive. And this includes pot dispensaries, arcades, who promote giveaways. These companies and others say that the idea is to support the country's vaccination program at a critical time during its rollout. And if a side effect is a boost for business, all the better. Oh, I'm sure that they had that in mind all along.
So,
in Israel, for example.
Weed and video games.
They somehow go together, don't they?
I'm seeing a correlation
and
here.
Krispy Kremes.
And Krispy Kreme.
As if you know, what do they say about getting hungry? I would not know. I never smoked pot, Cyrus, seriously. Never in my life, not even once.
And you grew up in the 60s.
Well, I was a kid in the 60s. I was a teenager in the 70s. But no, I never smoked pot. It doesn't say anything about me. I think I was just too worried about what my parents would do if they found out. So it wasn't like I was super valiant. I just never wound up smoking pot. But anyway, in Israel, municipalities have given out free drinks, free pizza, free cholent, which is, or it's probably pronounced Cholent, I think. It's a traditional beef stew as enticements to get vaccinated. In Dubai, some restaurants have offered 20% discounts for those who have received their shots. In Greenhouse of Walled Lake, a marijuana dispensary in Walled Lake, Michigan, they're offering customers a free pre-rolled joint with an estimated value of $10 for those who show proof of vaccination. I think it's ridiculous, but I'm, you know, Mr. Non-Pot Smoking Guy. I'm just going to pass over your discreet silence, Cyrus.
I'm just wondering, I don't understand. I don't understand how, I mean, these companies will just use anything for a promotional opportunity.
You know what their slogan is?
Huh?
Pot for shots.
That's so stupid.
It is.
That's so dumb.
Pot for shots. It's a promotion. But here's the thing. They've given away at least 6,000 free pre-rolled joints.
I'm surprised.
Pot for shots.
I'm surprised.
They're not taking pot shots.
The stoners remember to go get their free. they get the vaccine and they're like, what was I doing?
Now, their competitor, so that's the Greenhouse of Walled Lake Marijuana Dispensary, okay, in Michigan. They have a competitor. The competitor is You Baked Cannabis Company. It's a marijuana processor and grower. Why did I say grower? Grower. Their incentive is called Pokes for Tokes. So you can either get pot for shots or pokes for totes. Tokes. As in one toke over the line. Remember that song?
This is so dumb.
It's ridiculous. They say that this is part of their ongoing campaign to normalize cannabis. Gross. William Stevens, a resident of Sterling Heights, Michigan, is racking up the deals while he can. With his proof of vaccination, he scored a free joint at Greenhouse Walled Lake this past week, and he stopped in for a free donut at his local Krispy Kreme because cause and effect, right?
Yeah.
I wouldn't know from personal experience. I would not know. He says, I know a gift when I see it. He's 72 years old. He says he's hoping for even more with his vaccine card. He said, what would really rock my boat is free golf. Some have questioned the Krispy Kreme promotion as sending a contradictory message, since eating too many donuts arguably goes against the idea of safeguarding health. Dr. Lena Wen, the former queen of Corpse Mountain, she was formerly the president of Planned Parenthood. I don't know now who is the queen of Corpse Mountain. Who took her place? I don't know. But she used to be the queen of Corpse Mountain at Planned Parenthood. She's a physician and public health professor at George Washington University. She says, if you took advantage of Krispy Kreme's offer every day and made no other changes to diet or lifestyle, you would pack on an extra 15 pounds by year's end. Word to the wise, Cyrus.
This is extremely dangerous to our democracy.
Yes. They're giving away free cheesecake at a restaurant and bakery in New York City. Junior's, by the way, if you live in that area. Back of the house, it's a restaurant in San Francisco. They're offering vaccinated customers free French fries. And there's free chips and salsa at Uno Dos Tacos restaurant. That must be named after the song.
Don't you already get free chips and salsa at Mexican restaurants?
I think you already get that.
yeah, you got that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, we're giving you this free chips. Up Down is a Midwest chain of arcades. They're offering vaccinated customers a deal of 5 free tokens. Get it? Huh? 5 free tokens. And what's the last one? I don't know. It's a long list. So they're getting into the action.
Well, I guess the good news is if you've got your vaccination card, go get your free stuff. Go get it. Good for you.
Yeah.
Pokes for Tokes.
Yeah, that is not a good garage band name.
No.
Okay, back to the phones. Oh, by the way, before I forget, I've got some really great news. Everybody, you probably remember Sam, our good friend who lives down in Athens, Georgia, home of REM, which is why you always hear him and I say Automatic for the People. That's not only a name of one of their albums, it's also a sign on the front of I believe it's a restaurant, if I'm not mistaken, or some such place. Anyway, I asked Sam, knowing that he was coming into the Catholic Church this last Easter Vigil a couple of days ago, I asked him to please be sure to have somebody take pictures and do some video. And indeed he did, and I posted those on Twitter. My address or my comment was, right on, Sam, welcome home to the Catholic Church. Congratulations and God bless you. Christ is risen. So if you want to see Sam in all his glory, you'll see him by going to my Twitter feed, at Patrick Madrid. Be sure to leave a comment for Sam. Tell him how you feel. Tell him whatever you'd like to say to him in honor of his big day. and you'll see him being received into the church. There's also some video that I posted as well. So if you've heard Sam's voice and you've thought, I wonder what that guy looks like, you'll see him. And his sponsor, she introduced herself to me on Twitter. I forget her name, but you'll see her smiling face there as well. And so we're very happy for Sam. And as he tells the story, it was listening to this program for years that eventually led him to the door of the Catholic Church. Praise God. Okay, back to the phones. Let's go to Sharon listening in St. Petersburg, Florida. Hi, Sharon. Thanks for waiting.
Happy Easter, Patrick.
Happy Easter. Christ is risen.
Amen. Hey, the question that I had was about the book of John. On during the arrest of Jesus, when it says that when he said to them, I am he, they drew back and fell down to the ground. Did they literally fall down to the ground? And if so, how do we know that? Or what do we know about that? Why would they fall down to the ground?
Mm-hmm. Could be a couple of reasons. One would be, how do we know this? First of all, because the apostles were there in the garden and they witnessed it. So those apostles mm-hmm. who wrote, so that would be Matthew and John, they were eyewitnesses. And the others who were there, if they had been asked by, say, St. Luke or St. Mark, they would know as well. So it's for that reason that we have it there. So when we're told that they fell to the ground, this is in John chapter 18, I think that could be for one or two reasons. One would be the fact that they recognized Jesus, oh, you're the guy who was raising the dead. You're the guy mm-hmm. who was preaching these profound messages and who was healing people and all the things that you were doing. We're arresting you because they held Jesus, some of them anyway, in very high regard. I'm pretty certain that maybe some of those guards might even have witnessed his triumphal entry into Jerusalem the Sunday before on Palm Sunday. Now, the other reason is because he used a phrase that is translated into Greek as I am he, the Greek is, he says, ego eimi. Now, that phrase, I am he, or I am, is redolent of what God said to Moses in Exodus chapter 3, when Moses, you may remember me talking about this, I think it was Friday of last week, where Moses asked for God's name, and he says, I am who am. Tell them I am sent you. So keep in mind that the people in the garden are all Jews. So you have the Jewish guard who guard the temple. You have the whatever scribes and Pharisees may have been there, and also, of course, the apostles. So Jesus almost certainly was not speaking in Greek. He was most likely speaking in Aramaic or Hebrew, and he uttered the name of God. And so by him saying that, they could fall to the ground for one of two reasons. One would be that they recognized in some way that he was God, and the other possibility is that they felt that he was blaspheming. So they sort of fell down, they staggered because they couldn't believe what they were hearing. Either possibility seems likely to me. But that, to me, seems to be the underlying meaning there of why they fell to the ground.
Okay.
Does that help, Sharon?
Hey, before I hang up, may I say that I am very excited. I'm in the St. Pete area and very close to Seminole. And I'm really looking forward to seeing both of your talks on Saturday, April the 17th.
I am Seminole, very excited Florida. About being there. I am too. I look forward to meeting you in person, Sharon.
Yes, sir. And I wanted you to know that I go back to the mighty St. Gabriel, and I'm originally from Columbus, Ohio.
Are you
and
really?
And I used to listen to you on the mighty St. Gabriel.
Well, so, I remember fondly those days when my show was carried on St. Gabriel Radio, and I hope that maybe someday it will be again. But yeah, they're great people doing great work, St. Gabriel Radio in Columbus, yes. Ohio. God bless them.
Well, that's how it all got started. So, but anyway, yeah, looking forward to seeing you on Saturday, April the 17th at Blessed Sacrament Catholic Church.
Thanks, Sharon. I appreciate it, and I'll look forward to meeting you too. Thank you. Let's go now to Nancy in Indiana. Good morning, Nancy.
Good morning, Patrick. I'll get right to my question.
Sure.
Actually, it's a two-parter, and they're related. At services on Good Friday, The priest announced that they had an abundance of consecrated hosts, and so they were going to be distributing two or three hosts per person. Mm-hmm. And I had never heard of anything like that before, and I was taken aback and startled, and I didn't know what to do. And so I didn't receive. I just wanted to err on the side of caution in case that was improper.
It actually is not. So sometimes this happens. It's not common. But if there's an abundance of hosts that are not going to be kept in the tabernacle and the priest wants them to be consumed, he, of course, can consume them. And if there's just too many, it's not improper for you or other faithful who are there at Mass to receive them. So even if he gave you two or three or something like that, that's not improper.
Okay. And the second part of the question, which when I saw that happen, it made me twice as glad that I had not chosen to receive. And that was that the deacon was holding up three and he dropped one, which no surprise there, I don't think. He dropped one and he picked it up and handed it right to the worshiper and didn't do anything to the floor. Yeah. So then I was at not my parish. And so I was at an unfamiliar one and I thought, well, there's two things right in a row that have me concerned about their treatment of the host. So I am sure that in the second instance, they didn't handle that correctly. But like I said, once that happened, it kind of made me feel like, oh yeah, maybe they don't know what they're doing here. But what's your response to the second situation, Patrick?
Well, that's not unheard of course, for the host to fall out of somebody's hands. It happens, and I would think that it would happen simply as an accident. I don't think there's cause to think that the deacon was being negligent. I don't know. I mean, I wasn't there, obviously, but as I say, I like to give people the benefit of the doubt. I like it when people give me the benefit of the doubt. So let's assume the best and assume that it wasn't a matter of negligence. It was just one of those things that happens from time to time. It's an accident. We can't help it sometimes. But you're right that the proper way of handling that situation after the fact would be that usually what will happen is the communion line will stop. The priest will call for an altar boy to bring maybe a corporal from the sacristy, or could be just a white cloth. And then they place it over the spot where the host fell because of the possibility of particles being on the floor. And we don't want that because even the tiniest particle of the host has the real presence in it. So then nobody would step on that piece of cloth. And then when Mass was over, or at least when communion was over, then the priest could return with some holy water and a cloth and then gather up anything that might have remained on the floor where the host was. And then that cloth would be taken back to the sacristy. So showing some reverence would be the traditional way of handling it. I wonder if maybe because there has been a loss, generally speaking, in many Catholics' understanding of the Eucharist and who that is, what that is, that maybe for some it's no worse for them than if an ordinary piece of bread fell on the floor. I don't know. It's hard to know what's going through somebody's mind, but that might be one explanation. But in any case, that's how I would have handled it if I had been the deacon. So let's hope that you don't see more of that. But when you do, you yourself can just offer a little prayer. Lord, you know, I realize that this is unfortunate, but I love you. Just a little act of reparation, perhaps. Thanks, Nancy. Let's take a break, and then we'll come back with more of the Patrick Madrid Show. When we return, I've got a couple things I want to share with you. I think you're going to like these. First of all is what's commonly called the God hypothesis and what that means. It's making a comeback. And also, I'm going to share with you three major scientific discoveries in the past century that point to the existence of God. I'll be right back with that right after this.
Me, man.
Keeping it relevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. The Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
If you have a heart for this program, give me a call at 888-914-9149. You're knocking me off balance, Iris. 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. Cyrus, I'm a magic man. What can I say? And all the people out there listening are saying, I'm crazy about you.
Oh, boy.
Where does it end?
Where does it end? It ends right there.
These dreams of yours. All right.
You could have a whole conversation with nothing but song titles.
I could. Yeah. I'm still thinking about, what is it? The freebie frenzy?
Yeah.
Did you mark that down for the list?
No.
Come on.
Freebie frenzy.
Part of your job description.
That's true.
Put the garage band names on the list. All right. Okay, so 888-914-9149. Three major scientific discoveries in the past century that point to God. You may say, what are these three scientific discoveries? Well, I shall tell you. First, a little preamble. Polling data, this according to the Federalist, polling data now show that an increasing number of young people, including those from religious homes, doubt even the existence of God. This may describe your own children. Moreover, polls probing such young, religiously unaffiliated agnostics and atheists have found that science, or at least the claims of putative spokesmen for science, have played an outsized role in cementing disaffection with religious belief. In one, this is referring to one of the polls, more than two-thirds of self-described atheists and one-third of agnostics affirm, quote, the findings of science make the existence of God less probable. I always laugh when I see this. Because, first of all, let's just do a quick reminder. This is a quick PSA. Science deals with pre-given physical realities. Science deals with physical realities, things that you can observe, things that with your senses you can quantify, you can measure, etc. This is the province of science. That's what science does. And, you know, hip, hip, hooray for science. I love science. I'm grateful for scientists. I'm happy, very happy to be living in the era of Advil and air conditioning and anesthesia, etc. So I have nothing but great things to say about science and how much I love it and how much I want more of it. I want more science. Let's have some more science, please. Let's have some more breakthroughs. That's what I'm all about. But whenever somebody makes the claim that science somehow can prove or disprove or it points to a greater or lesser chance of God existing, whenever I see somebody say that, I have to chuckle because that person doesn't understand science. I mean, you could even be a scientist who says something crazy like that. But here's the thing. Science, as I said, deals with pre-given physical realities. By definition, it can't say anything one way or the other about the existence of God. Why? Because God is immaterial. God does not exist in time and space. God is beyond the tools of science to measure and observe.
Yeah, Patrick, tell us.
All right. God is a pure spirit. The supernatural realm is purely spiritual. It does not have, at least not in the sense that scientists today think of it, it doesn't take up space. It's not physical in that sense. Are there physical bodies in heaven? Yes. Two of that we know of for sure. The resurrected glorified body of Jesus and the resurrected glorified body of the Blessed Virgin Mary. But let's put those two facts off to the side for a minute, because we're not talking about glorified resurrected bodies. We know from Scripture, for example, that Jesus and his glorified resurrected body could walk through walls. And heck, even before he died on the cross and rose from the dead, he was able to walk on water. So that's a dimension of what we think of as physical that we won't delve into for the moment. But let's just talk about pure physical things, purely material things. That's what science deals with. So it no more makes any sense for someone to say, well, science has shown that the likelihood of God's existence is even more minimal than we thought. Science can do no such thing. It's about the same as saying, well, the rules of Spanish grammar have shown the precise chemical composition of the soil on Mars. What? Yeah, you know, Spanish grammar in syntax, in orthography, all the rules of the Spanish language, we have applied those rules to determine the precise chemical composition of the soil on Mars. What? That's ridiculous. Because the grammar and orthological and vocabulary rules, etc., of Spanish have nothing whatsoever to do with the soil anywhere, whether on Mars or on Earth or anywhere. And they can't measure anything that has to do with that because it's not the right tool for that. What's the right tool for that? Philosophy. Logic. That is the domain. That is the science that deals with those issues. Can science prove, for example, that something is moral or immoral? Huh? Can you apply the scientific method, properly so-called, to an immoral or ethical situation and scientifically prove that something is right or wrong? Of course not. Because science doesn't deal with those issues. It can't. That would be an area for ethics. Now, ethics, of course, is just a sub-branch of the greater discipline of philosophy. So I think you get the point. So it's not hard to say, to see rather, and this, again, according to the article in, where is this? The Federalist, three major scientific discoveries in the past century that point to God. It's not hard to see how many people might have acquired this impression since the 2006 popular new atheist writers such as Richard Dawkins, Sam Harris, Christopher Hitchens, Daniel Dennett, Stephen Hawking, Bill Nye, the science guy. He dances too, I think. And Lawrence Krauss. They have published a series of best-selling books arguing that science renders religious belief impossible, or at least implausible. To that, I laugh. According to Dawkins and others, Darwinian evolution in particular establishes that the universe we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is, at bottom, no design, no purpose, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. But does science actually support this strictly materialistic vision of reality? The author of the article asks. In fact, three major scientific discoveries during the last century contradict the expectations of scientific atheists or materialists and point instead in the direction of a distinctly theistic reality. First, cosmologists. And by the way, people who learn the word cosmology, they like to use it a lot because I think they think it impresses people. It just simply has to do with the universe and how the universe came into existence. That's what that word means. In case you didn't know, cosmologists have discovered that the physical universe likely had a beginning, contrary to the expectations of scientific materialists who had long portrayed the material universe as eternal and self-existent, and therefore in no need of an external creator. By the way, I'll pause there. It still has a need of an external creator because it would be a logical impossibility for something that is itself finite and limited and contingent, meaning that the things in it did not have to be here, and we can prove that because at one time these things like planets and solar systems and galaxies, at one time they didn't exist. So there's still the need to establish how all this came into existence. So just to propose or to posit the idea of an eternal material universe in itself doesn't answer the question. So the first evidence, the first of these three major scientific discoveries, the first is of a cosmic beginning that came, and this is the evidence of it, that came in the 1920s when astronomers discovered that light coming from distant galaxies was being stretched out or redshifted as if the galaxies were moving away from us. Soon after, a Belgian priest and physicist, Father Georges Lemaître, and Caltech astronomer Edwin Hubble, of the Hubble telescope fame, independently showed that galaxies farther away from Earth were receding faster than those close at hand. That suggested a spherical expansion of the universe and space, like a balloon inflating from a singular explosive beginning, from a Big Bang. The author of this article, by the way, is Stephen C. Meyer. He has his PhD in the philosophy of science. Father Lemaître also showed that Einstein's equations describing gravity most naturally implied a dynamic, evolving universe, despite Einstein's initial attempt to gerrymander his own equations to depict the universe as eternally existing and static, in other words, neither contracting nor expanding. In 1931, Albert Einstein visited Hubble at the Mount Wilson Observatory in California to view the redshift evidence for himself. He later announced that denying the evidence of a beginning was the greatest blunder of his scientific career. Those are his words. This evidence of a beginning of the universe, later reinforced by other developments in observational astronomy and theoretical physics, not only contradicted the expectations of scientific materialists, it confirmed those of traditional theists. As physicist and Nobel laureate Arno Penzias observed, quote, "The best data we have," this is referring to a beginning of the universe, "the best data we have are exactly what I would have predicted had I nothing to go on but the first five books of Moses, the Psalms, and the Bible as a whole." The second of these three major scientific discoveries is that physicists discovered that we live in a kind of Goldilocks universe. You remember the story of Goldilocks, Cyrus? Can you tell me?
Never heard of it.
Yeah. Well, you remember, you know, the three bears and the porridge? This one's too hot. This one's too cold. This one's just right. Remember that?
That's starting to come back to me. Thanks.
It's all starting to come back to you. Okay. I don't know if Goldilocks Universe would be a good garage band name. I don't think so. Indeed, since the 1960s, physicists have determined that the fundamental physical laws and parameters of our universe have been finely tuned against all odds to make our universe capable of hosting life. Even slight alterations in the values of many independent factors, such as the strength of gravitational and electromagnetic attraction, the masses of elementary particles, and the initial arrangement of matter and energy in the universe, would have rendered life on Earth impossible. Not surprisingly, many physicists have concluded that this improbable fine-tuning for life points to a cosmic fine-tuner. As former Cambridge astrophysicist Sir Fred Hoyle argued, quote, "A common sense interpretation of the data suggests that a super intellect has monkeyed with the physics to make life possible." How does Scooby-Doo say it?
Roro.
To avoid this conclusion, some physicists have postulated a vast number of other universes. This multiverse idea portrays our universe as the outcome of a grand lottery in which some universe-generating mechanism spits out billions and billions of universes, so many that our universe, with its improbable combination of life-conducive factors, would eventually have to arise. So this basically is, if you had an infinity of monkeys, an infinity of chimpanzees typing on typewriters for infinity, eventually they would come up with War and Peace. That's basically that theory, which is bogus. Yet, advocates of the multiverse overlook an obvious problem. All such proposals, whether based on inflationary cosmology or string theory, postulate universe-generating mechanisms that themselves, here we go, themselves require prior unexplained fine-tuning, thus taking us back to where we started and the need for an ultimate fine-tuner. Quick pause here. This in philosophy and specifically in logic is referred to begging the question. Everybody uses the phrase begging the question wrong nowadays. They mean, when they say it, they mean this leads to another question. So if you hear somebody say, "Cyrus was gone from work for 20 minutes yesterday," that begs the question, did he go to Krispy Kreme to get a free donut?
I don't think so.
That's the wrong use of the phrase begs the question. It's not what it means. To say begs the question does not mean that it leads to another question. What it means is, in logic, is that it doesn't answer the question. It simply begs it. In other words, to claim that, okay, well, here's how we account for the Goldilocks universe that we live in, where everything is so fine-tuned and everything is just perfect within an extremely narrow band within which life can exist, but outside of it on either side, life couldn't exist. Well, that's just because of the multiverse. And we've got trillions of other universes, and it just so happens that we live in this very improbable one where life can actually exist. That is begging the question. That's not an answer to the question. That's called in Latin petitio ad principii, which means to beg to the beginning, or to say beg the question, which means you just push it back one step. That's all. You've just pushed it back because you still have to account for what generated this multiverse. It doesn't answer the question, in other words. Continuing, the third and final of these three discoveries in molecular biology has revealed the presence of digital code at the foundation of life. You and I know that is DNA. After James Watson and Francis Crick elucidated the structure of the DNA molecule in 1953, Crick developed his famed sequence hypothesis. In it, Crick proposed that the chemical constituents in DNA function like letters in a written language or digital symbols in a computer code. Functioning computer code depends upon a precise sequence of zeros and ones, the dreaded binary. Similarly, the DNA molecule's ability to direct the assembly of crucial protein molecules in cells depends upon specific arrangements of chemical constituents called bases along the spine of its double helix structure. Thus, even Richard Dawkins has acknowledged, quote, the machine code of the genes is uncannily computer-like. Uh-huh. Or as Bill Gates explains, quote, DNA is like a computer program, but far, far more advanced than any software we've ever created. Uh-huh. No theory, continuing, and this is the end, no theory of undirected chemical evolution has explained the origin of the information in DNA, or RNA for that matter, needed to build the first living cell from simpler non-living chemicals. Instead, our uniform and repeated experience, the basis of all scientific reasoning, shows that systems possessing functional or digital information invariably arise from intelligent causes. Let me just pause here for a second. Your DNA, well, really any DNA, but your DNA contains a very highly precise, massive amount of information or code, if you want to think in computer terms, about you. It not only says vast amounts about you physiologically, but it also is code. It's information that tells the cells what to do. The cells, they're obviously not sentient beings. They don't have minds. They don't make decisions, but they respond to the code that is imparted to them through your DNA, in your DNA. So the point here is that this is clearly pointing to some kind of encoder. Somebody who wrote the code, so to speak.
Wow!
Mm-hmm. We know from experience, the article says, that software comes from programmers. We know generally that information, whether inscribed in hieroglyphics, written in a book, or encoded in radio signals, always arises from an intelligent source. So the discovery of information and a complex information transmission and processing system, aka your DNA, which is in every living cell, provides strong grounds for inferring, doesn't prove it, but it strongly suggests that intelligence played a role in life's origin. As information theorist Henry Quastler observed, quote, information habitually rises from conscious activity. Lastly, here's the last bit. Historian of science Frederick Burnham notes, quote, the idea that God created the universe is a more respectable hypothesis today than at any time in the last 100 years. Now, the author of the book, his name again is Stephen C. Meyer. He has his PhD in the philosophy of science. He refers to his book called Return of the God Hypothesis. He says, I concur and argue that recent scientific discoveries about biological and cosmological origins have decidedly theistic implications, suggesting that popular scientific reports of the death of God may have been, to adapt Mark Twain's famous quip, greatly exaggerated. You know, and the nice thing about that is it's so simple. It's not something that's only available or accessible to the elite scientists. Anybody can learn this. Now, when we return, we'll come back to your phone calls. I also want to share with you another scientific angle here with regard to the possible existence of God. It's called the God hypothesis, and it's making a comeback. And I'll tell you what it is and why it's happening right after this.
That's almost ingenious right there.
The programming you hear throughout the day on the Relevant Radio Network is sponsored in part by Christendom College. More info at getprinciples.com. We thank them for supporting Relevant Radio.
This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and relevantradio.com.
We're back. Let's go to Paul in Long Beach, California. Hi, Paul. Welcome.
Hey, hi, Patrick. How you doing?
Sure.
Patrick, thank you. The average person, fascinating article you just read. The average person always runs into the sitting around the intelligent design versus the Big Bang theory. And I would just like to put it out there, as I heard Father Spitzer put it once, all these elements that are required to make an explosion, to make a bang, send shockwaves, well, if there was no universe and no matter to support them, well, where did they come from? They don't. Atoms aren't born, or they follow scientific law. But there was no law. There was nothing. And there was no matter. Even Einstein wrote E equals MC squared. That didn't exist. There was no matter.
Right.
So please tell me where the intelligent design didn't come into play. That's what I would put out there.
I agree. Well, I put it this way, Paul, much more succinctly. What banged? If there was a big bang, and I don't doubt that there was a big bang. I don't doubt it for a moment. I'm entirely satisfied with that hypothesis. But something banged. What was it? And that's the question that
that's
needs
right.
to be answered. Now, it could be there's an alternative to that. So if there was something there, however highly compressed or microscopic it may have been, I you know, that's science beyond my ken. That seems to be one possibility, that there was something that exploded into what we know as the universe. Okay, so something had to be there in order for that to happen for the reasons that you just mentioned. Or the alternative is there was nothing there and God called all this into being. And what we call the Big Bang was God speaking into existence the very universe. I don't know of a third possibility. Either nothing was there and it was brought into existence ex nihilo, Latin for out of nothing, or there was something there that caused the start of the universe as we know it, but then we'd have to explain what was that thing and where did that thing come from.
That's right. And science yeah. doesn't support it coming out of nothing.
Yeah, because you can't get anything from nothing. Nothing comes from nothing. And from time to time, I'll read about people who say, oh, no, quantum theory has disproved that. And we can see how quarks or some other particle comes into existence or out of existence. Or I've seen this other experiment that certain particles that are moving, that they don't exist except as theoretical possibilities until they're observed. And then when they're observed, then they come into existence. That's another.
But if they're moving, that means, yeah, but if they're moving, that means there's energy at play. And energy
True.
Can't exist in nothing.
But this theory is, and I've followed it, I've looked at it closely, and I've followed it, and I can see how it does kind of create a paradox here, that with these scientific experiments showing particles moving toward a slit in a surface, that it's when the particle is observed, at least as I understand this theory, that's when it exists. And prior to that, it's just simply a probability, but it doesn't actually exist. So even that, it seems to me, would point to the existence of God, because if this is taking place before human beings, before animals, before, and let's just, you know, I don't know whether the theory holds that if a raccoon sees this happening, that suddenly that means it comes into existence. But let's posit that this is taking place billions of years before any sentient life existed. So there's nobody to witness any of these things, and yet they do exist. They come into existence. Well, that would argue for somebody who observed it, and that person would be God. Anyway.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much.
You're welcome, Paul. Great to talk to you. I appreciate it. Let's go now to Melanie in South Milwaukee. Hi, Melanie.
Hi, Patrick. Sorry I'm so off topic. I just wondered whether
That's
you
okay.
attended the Novus Ordo Mass or the Tridentine Mass.
For Easter Vigil, we attended the traditional Latin Mass. And the Novus Ordo is the new order of the Mass that's celebrated at our parish. But we happened to go with one of our sons to a parish in the diocese that celebrates the traditional Mass. So that's where we were for Easter Vigil.
How wonderful. Because I heard you last week talking about how you receive on the tongue, but mm-hmm. it's not being allowed in parishes around, at least here. Is it being allowed by you?
Well, I myself have no say in the matter, but yes, in our diocese, there's a strong encouragement for people to receive on the tongue, and I would say, I'm sorry, on the hand, and most people do, but it's by no means forbidden. I mean, there are any number of Catholics who receive on the tongue, who have continued to receive on the tongue ever since COVID started, and it's been fine.
Well, that's lucky them.
Yeah. I think that the pastoral decision to force people to only receive communion in the hand and not to receive communion on the tongue, I think that's an unnecessary exaggeration. It's an over-the-top precaution that scientifically is not really borne out. It's unfortunate, but it is what it is. What can I say?
Right. I agree with you. Thank you.
You're welcome. Happy Easter, Melanie. Christ is risen. Let's go to Cindy now, listening in Monrovia, California. I used to live in Monrovia, California when I was a little kid, Cindy. Not that it matters.
Oh,
but
really?
Yeah, I was probably down the street from where you are now. I don't know.
The reason I'm calling is my mother used to be a Eucharistic minister for her parish, and she now has dementia. And we were visiting yesterday for Easter Sunday, and we were going through her rosaries because the rosary hour was coming up, and we were going to do the rosary with Father Rocky. Anyway, I opened up, I found her little case that she kept the host in. And
Oh no, don't tell me she had a consecrated host in there.
No, but okay. I think there were little tiny grains. I put the rosary in there and I thought, oh my gosh, I took it right back out again. Is that something I have to take to the priest in the parish or how do?
Yeah. Here's what will happen. So if those are almost certainly, if that's where she kept the host. Now, let's take a step back. If she was bringing Holy Communion to sick people, for example, the norm is to carry the Holy Eucharist in a little metal container known as a PYX, P-Y-X. Is that what this is, or is this something different?
I believe it is. She told me that that's what it is, and it's a little gold-colored case with the PX on the top of it.
Okay. Is it made of metal? I'm guessing it probably is, right?
I'm pretty sure that's what it is.
Okay. Yeah, that's good. That's a good thing because that's the proper sacred vessel to carry the Holy Eucharist in if you're carrying it away from Mass for somebody who's sick, for example. So what you would do then is bring that to the parish priest and explain to him that your mother used to be an extraordinary minister of Holy Communion, and whether inadvertently or who knows, there are still some elements of a consecrated host in the PYX. What he will do, he will take it from you and he will put those fragments in a bowl of water and let them dissolve. And the thing to know here is that the real presence of Christ remains in the host as long as it has the external characteristics and properties of bread. Now, it obviously isn't bread anymore. It's now the body, blood, soul, and divinity of Jesus under the appearances of bread. But the outward characteristics of bread remain. So the real presence of Christ remains in that host for as long as the characteristics of bread remain. But as soon as it starts to break down and ceases to be bread anymore, that's when the real presence of Christ leaves. So what the priest would do is he would get a little basin or a little bowl of holy water, or, you know, it didn't have to be holy water, but that's pretty common. And the particles would go in there, and then they would just sit and dissolve. Over time, they would dissolve. And then once it's all dissolved and it's really clear, it's really obvious that the real presence of Christ is gone because it's obvious that it's no longer bread, then there's a special drain in the sacristy known as the sagrarium. And that's where that water with those, you know, what would now be bread, that's where that would go. That would be the appropriate way to dispose of that. So the first thing you should do then is bring it to your parish priest and then he'll handle it.
Okay. Yeah, okay, all right. I just thought, oh my gosh, I know I heard about this, either the Lenten lessons or listening to one of the radio hosts on this radio station talking about this. Oh no, I have to call in to find out what to do with it.
Well, now you know.
Okay, thank you so much. Now I know.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Cindy. Great to talk to you, and happy Easter. Cyrus, what do you think? Time for a call or no call?
You've got time.
Okay. Let's go to Christy in Jefferson, Wisconsin. Hi, Christy.
Hi, Patrick. I had a question. I was approached by my older sons in their early 20s, late teens, and they all sort of attacked me with a question of, hey, if God knows everything that's going to happen and he knows if you're going to go to heaven or hell from the moment he creates you in your mother's womb, how do we have free will? Why would read you? But first of all, we obviously don't have free will because God knows we're going to hell or going to heaven.
Yeah, this, you know, this is a conundrum that many people wonder about that I've never had a problem with. It's never caused me any issue, and I can see what I think I can see pretty clearly the answer to this question, but since I've only got about 60 seconds, I can't do justice to it. So what about this, Christy? What if you stand by, and then when we come back for our third hour, I'll start with you, and we'll take it from the top. Does that sound good?
That would be beautiful. Thank you, Patrick.
Okay, because this is one of those topics, Christy, that, as you can guess, it deserves an adequate answer, and I'll do my best to give you one on the other side of this.
Well, I hate to disappoint you, but I will have to circle back with you on that as well.
That's what I'll do, Christy. I will circle back with you on this topic as well. Let's see. So there's no more time to do anything else, and so we're just going to sit here and wait for the music to start playing. We're just going to tap our fingers.
Just twiddle your thumbs.
I know there's music coming.
Now.
It's coming. I can feel it. There we go. Okay. Whew. Okay, so we made it to the end of the second hour. We're about to start hour three right after this. When we return, I will respond to Christy's excellent question posed to her by her young adult sons. If God knows everything, then how do you have free will? And if you don't have free will, how can you be guilty of a sin? And if you're not guilty of a sin, why would you go to hell? I'll be right back.